The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benrood from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
I'm Elena Clevenger, and our next story is Here's How It Happens by Suvi Towsend. They bonded over zombies while at a writer's convention. Perched on a settee near the hotel bar, she claimed legends of the undead spawned from historical fact, an ancient disease. He thought zombies would arise from hubris, like in a Stephen King novel. She was a biologist and an amateur archaeologist, though, and he was a gentleman. He pretended to defer to her wisdom, but not until long after midnight, when everyone else had drifted off to bed. Are you wondering if they have names, he and she? Perhaps you want to confirm the story isn't about you or someone you know. Allow me the veil of anonymity. Names aren't important here. This isn't a love story. Woven into their debate, he confessed a love for Diana Wynne Jones' books, and she sang Careless Whisper in a voice husky with whiskey and lingering cough. At first glance, you'd think them well-matched, two 20-somethings, flushed with each other's company. But she was of middle age, married, and remember, this isn't a love story. They were both writers, he accrediting words on a novel. She stalled after a few years' successes. When he mentioned his job as a freight truck driver, she swore she had a story that needed his expertise. Of course he'd help, he said, laughing. A handshake sealed the deal. Then her eyes grew unfocused, revealing a hidden depth of age. Here's how it will happen, she said. In 10 to 15 years, after you've forgotten me while becoming the next Neil Gaiman, you'll get a manuscript from an unfamiliar address and a note saying, "Tell me where it's wrong." He grinned and shook his head. "I doubt I'm the next Gaiman, and I don't forget people." She raised a finger from her whiskey glass. "You'll be busy with deadlines and red carpets, so the manuscript will sit until a moment of boredom. The story, something about the undead, will reference Howl's Moving Castle and George Michael songs, reminders of this quirky woman you once met. You'll send the story back with corrections, imagining you'll reconnect with this forgotten friend, but you won't, even after the story wins a major award." "Nice, shooting for the stars." He smiled and stretched, looking around the empty bar. "So, you can see the future?" She shook the cloudiness from her gaze. "Just a long experience with the past." He didn't forget her. Not that first year. Before they parted by the elevator, he'd emailed her his novel draft. By the time his flight home landed the next evening, she'd returned a critique illuminating where the story shone, so he saw instantly where it didn't. Afterwards, he called her, sometimes daily, while his truck rolled over miles of tarmac to discuss the book's problems or their own. His novel sold quickly. Between edits and drafting the sequel, the phone calls dwindled. Then she went on an extended dig in Romania. The last time they talked, she was in the hospital, recovering from a little nothing she'd picked up mucking through dank catacombs. The rest happened as she'd predicted. He sat in his study 12 years later, head propped on one hand as he read her story. When he'd finished, his desk light shimmered on a face sheened with tears. She'd threaded in everything they'd talked about that first evening. A long-dormant fungus that reanimated flesh, its discovery by a scientist researching eternal youth, the resulting zombie plague defeated by fire, his days hauling freight, the magical kingdom of Ingeri, their love of 80s pop, Those weren't what tore his heart. This isn't a love story, and neither was that story of hers. But how else to explain the loss that scarred the pages trembling in his hand if it wasn't love she'd lost? The shelves of his books, the posters for film adaptions, were each now an accusation of guilt. He'd forgotten about her, but clearly she hadn't forgotten him. Guilt fumbled his hand from the phone whenever he tried to call, but when her story was nominated for that award, he went to the ceremony. As her win was announced, he scanned the crowd, unsure how she'd look after 13 years. Silence drew his attention back to the podium. The presenter regretted the winner could not attend. She'd died the previous day. By the time he reached her hometown, the funeral was over. A stranger opened the door at her house, impossibly weathered to be husband to the woman he remembered. He'd come bearing her award statuette, which granted him access to the house and her basement lab, with its racks of mummified tissue samples and petri dishes sprouting molds. Two walls held bookshelves of lab notes, biology texts, novels, and histories chronicling the mythology of the undead. Her husband watched from the top of the stairs. "Burn it all," she said, "her life's work." Our hero froze. Her story's plot unreeled in his head, implications cold against the grief burning within. He sprinted upstairs. Was she cremated? She asked, "But how could I?" Her husband collapsed against a chair. Photos of their life together covered the living room, 40 years of history framing her beautiful, unchanging face. At the local Walmart, he bought a propane torch. He didn't know if it would help. Surely his suspicions were just a writer's imagination run wild. Twilight dimmed the cemetery paths, but the square of artificial grass was easy to find. He stood by her grave and tried to predict what would come next. The police, the news. Would they believe that he, author of Make-Believe Monsters and Unlikely Heroes, was telling the truth? He spun variations of the story to account for his presence in the graveyard, the burning of an unearthed corpse, trying as always to retain the truth of the tale, as I've done, slanting the facts, but only telling one lie. Torch in hand, he pulled away the blanket of fake turf and waited for the earth to shift.
My name is Mike Rumble, and I'm going to read Double or Nothing by Alter S. Reese. When my copy walked into my bathroom with a pistol drawn, I wasn't even surprised. For one thing, while it'd been disturbing to see an exact copy of me walking around and doing things at first, I'd gotten used to it. That was why I'd had an android made to those specifications, after all. And while it wasn't great that it had gotten a weapon from somewhere and was planning on killing me, that wasn't too surprising. I'd been sending my copy into work as me ever since I'd got him, and one of the things I'd been doing with my new free time was catching up on my reading, so I knew how the stories went. "So you got the bleach and stuff?" I said. "I mean, it's probably the easiest room to clean up. But Janet's coming over on Tuesday, so you don't want to leave a spatter anywhere." The android gave me one of my puzzled looks.
"You're not going to try to stop me?" he said.
I shrugged. "I'm naked and in a bath," I said. "You've got a gun, doesn't seem worthwhile, and, honestly, you had to go sort out that address thing at the DMV like 5 times, so fair enough." The android raised the gun and then lowered it, his shoulders slumping.
"Honestly," he said, "it'd be easier if you were trying to fight me on this one."
I gave a soapy shrug. People who try to fight their robot doubles against all odds aren't the sort of people who get robot doubles to go to parent-teacher conferences. The gun came back up.
They made us sit in second grader chairs, he said, and we had to wait 20 minutes after our scheduled meeting, and Lisa was being snippy about Janet the whole fucking time.
I winced. Sorry. Honestly, once you replace me, there's going to be more of that, but at that point, none of it is going to be my problem. He gave a gusty sigh.
Yeah, he said. You're right. I mean, I'd have to take off Tuesday for the plumber, who probably isn't going to show up. So, you're going to have to start going to work some of the time, he said. And you're the one getting the passport done.
No deal. His expression hardened, and his grip tightened. But, I said, tell you what, I've got some money saved up. We could buy a robot to do things neither of us want to deal with.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading Stargazers by Todd Hanks. The grass looked lovely curling up around her bare feet. We sat under the stars, Emily and I, not caring about the rest of the population, not caring at that moment about bills, college classes, or the oncoming winter months. We only cared at that moment about ourselves, our love, and our interest in the stars above us. I had always been a student, in my spare time, of astronomy. As we held hands, I pointed out the constellations. I showed her the flying horse and the twins. She listened contentedly, as the wind played softly with her auburn hair. "Do you think there is life on other planets?" Emily asked softly. "Could be," I answered. "In the distant reaches of the universe, there are many planets that are a similar distance to their sun as we are to ours." "It's fascinating to think about," she mused. "Yes," I replied. "Other planets far away could have oxygen, rain, oceans, rivers, animals, and flowers." "And people," she added. "And people," I agreed. And we sat like that the rest of the night, watching clouds move like white horses before the full moon, until eventually the dawn arose like a pastel painting, yellows like a broken egg yolk, scarlet and light blues, red as deep as is found in coral reefs. And even as the sun came up, we continued to sit almost not moving, the tentacles from our heads wrapped around each other, and the tongues of our stomachs occasionally touched.
My name is Joe Campo, and I am reading Safe Space by Rich Larson.
I'm Elena Clevenger.
I'm Kurt Benrute. Elena and I are going to pitch in with the dialogue.
Novopolis was like no city Jen had ever seen in her life. The architecture flowed around her in graceful arcs and waves, all of it a gleaming white that seemed to gently press against her eyeballs. Battery pillars rose in small copses where denizens recharged their cycles. Glass-topped channels displayed sparkling clean water as it coursed through the blue veins of the city's filtration system. There were no engine sounds. Everything powered was as soft and melodic as the whisper train that had conducted her here in the first place. And everywhere she looked, there were custodians. Small white spheres that moved through the air like schools of fish. One such school had been waiting for her when she stepped off the platform, welcoming her in a synthetic chirp to Novopolis. The custodians explained that her refugee application had been accepted and her face and body metrics had been scanned into the system. She was officially a denizen. They had offered to guide her to her housing, but she'd elected to explore instead. All she had to carry was her battered violin case and the ratty backpack slung over her shoulder.
Even now that she'd wandered for hours, stopping once to press her palm to a mobile vendor and select a dish of steamed rice with chunks of fish or something like it, everything still felt like a dream. She wanted to be happy, but she still felt thick and numb, coated in scar tissue. She hoped she would be able to find candles to burn for the sister and mother and cousins and friends who had never made it to the Whisper train, or even gotten close. Jen was up on one of the floating balconies, looking out over her home when someone spoke from behind her.
"Excuse me."
She turned around and saw a man with a beautiful, somber face, long, lashed eyes, thick black hair that ruffled in the breeze. While most of the denizens she'd seen so far wore bright colors, he wore a black body glove that hugged his musculature, his broad shoulders and wiry arms. Everyone she'd seen in the city so far was beautiful, in that they were clean, with unblemished skin and straight white teeth, but nobody she'd seen had set her heart hammering like it did now.
"I noticed you get off the train,"
the man said, with a small apologetic smile.
"Not many refugees make it here anymore. And when they do, the custodians try to make it inconspicuous."
"Oh,"
said Jen. She couldn't think of anything else to say, too entranced by the richness of his voice, the intensity of his dark eyes as they locked to hers.
"I'm Prosper,"
he said, putting out his hand into the air between them. Jen stared at it for a moment, then remembered there were no contagions here. She gripped his fingers awkwardly and shook them the way she remembered seeing in blurring net shows when she was younger.
"I'm Jen,"
she said.
It's very beautiful here."
The man, Prosper, gave a sad smile.
"In its way, yes,"
he said.
"It's also very quiet."
He pointed to her violin case.
"I see that you're like me. You're an artist."
Jen shook her head fiercely, tucking the case deeper into her armpit.
"No, no,"
she said.
"I played a little for money, for food cred."
Prosper's eyes lit up.
"Incredible,"
he said.
"It must have felt incredible, like an open wound."
"An open wound?"
Jen echoed.
"Of course, you won't be able to play much here,"
Prosper said.
"Not in public places, anyway. Something about music, something about the waves and the sonics, it bothers the custodian's algorithms. That's why it's so damn quiet here."
"It's peaceful,"
Jen offered.
"How morgues are peaceful,"
Prosper said with a wink.
"Real cities, they have music, loud music. They have parties and drunks and graffiti and trash and fighting and dancing and arguing and sex in public places."
Jen felt her ears get hot at the last part, especially since Prosper, this strange and beautiful and confusing Prosper, was looking up and down her body.
"You have scars,"
he said.
"Actual scars."
"I know,"
Jen said, bristling for the first time.
"I think they're very beautiful."
Prosper's gaze roved up and down her arms, where her skin was pocked and pitted.
"You've suffered and survived. I'm glad."
Jen didn't know what made him glad, the suffering or surviving. She shook her head, less off balance now, more angry.
"They're ugly."
"I disagree,"
Prosper said, moving past her and swinging himself up onto the edge of the balcony. Just seeing it made Jen's stomach lurch.
"But in any case, you won't get any new ones here. It's very safe here."
"Good,"
Jen said curtly.
"I'm glad."
Prosper gave his sad smile again, shaking his head, then tipped himself backward off the balcony. Jen gave a holler of surprise and hurled forward, shedding her bag and violin, groping at the empty air where he'd been only a second before. Prosper was plummeting toward the stark white plaza below, limbs spread wide like a starfish. Jen couldn't stop herself screaming. Then a flock of custodians swooped underneath his black-clad body and stopped him in mid-freefall. Jen watched, disbelieving as the spheres carried him back up, 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 and gently deposited him back onto the balcony.
"Please be cautious in high places,"
they said in their scratchy, synthesized voice.
"See,"
Prosper said as they drifted away.
"It's too safe, too comfortable. We can't feel pain or shock or horror. We can't feel anything at all."
He raked his hands back through his hair, looking haunted.
And without feeling, there can't be creation. People here go see the same stupid plays, the same stupid AI-generated sculptures. It's all so dead and sterile.
Jen could feel a mounting rage inside her chest.
Dead things aren't sterile,
she said.
Dead things rot and infect and swell and stink. You've never seen a corpse, have you?
No,
Prosper said, with a fierce whisper.
No, I've never seen a corpse. I've never seen anything real. I've been in this horrible white void my entire life.
He gripped his head in both hands.
It's a prison. You've come to a prison, Jenna.
Then leave,
Jen said.
Get on the Whisper train and leave.
I've considered it 1,000 times,
Prosper said.
But that would mean giving up, abandoning this place to its sick, bland regurgitations. I want to save it. I want to bring it life, not just living. We need drama, passion, pain. You understand, don't you? You've seen it yourself. You know where art begins.
Jen stared for a moment, too stunned to speak. Then she reached down and opened her violin case.
Our first act of defiance,
Prosper said, his eyes lighting up.
Play, Jenna. Play until they come and tear the bow from your hands. You've suffered so much. You must have so much material.
Jen lifted the violin, knocking it to her chin on instinct, peering down its strings and seeing most needed tightening. Then she smashed it hard against the balcony railing. Wood crunched and splintered. A sliver flew past her eye. She swung it again and again until it was nothing but mangled pieces, until Prosper slunk away, until the custodians arrived to begin sweeping up her debris.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading The Forgetting by Leah Sipes. He thought about declining, of course. Everyone did. But he thought longer than most, sitting on the hard-backed orange chair of the immigration office, elbows on his knees. He had been there for 2 hours already, and the receptionist was watching him suspiciously. For most of the people in the waiting room, who came and went while he sat, the decision seemed to take less than 5 minutes. Why not? It was an incredible procedure, almost entirely painless, completely free. And it would change everything. The people who had done it didn't regret their choice. He had spoken to many of them before coming back. It had been easier the first time he was here, when he'd come prepared to decline. He had been braced for pressure, had fortified himself against scorn, had marshaled his arguments. Yes, he understood the benefits of the procedure. He didn't want them. He was willing to learn the new language the old-fashioned way, to speak haltingly and with an accent for the rest of his life, to struggle through phone conversations and rely on his children to fill out his medical forms. It was worth it to him. But nobody had pressured him. Nobody had argued. They had shrugged and stamped his papers and turned to the next person. He wondered now, if they hadn't bothered arguing because they had known he would be back. The others, who made their decision so quickly, they understood instinctively what he had been forced to learn. It was too late to say no. The procedure was common, and so it was necessary. There were no pockets of people from the old countries who were comfortable only around each other, no neighborhood where the signs were in letters familiar only to them, no gatherings where everyone knew their ways and their habits and their prejudices. For those who refused, there would only be the life they had chosen, and they would discover that they had chosen to be foreigners, to hide their strangeness every single second of every single day. He stood, slowly, heavily, and the receptionist narrowed her eyes as he approached. "I would like," he said, with as much dignity as he could manage, "to speak to someone about getting the procedure." The intake official was a short woman with a slash of red lipstick, who sat across the folding table from him and shuffled a pile of manila folders. Her impatience was like a scent, though the way she wrinkled her nose told him his scent was stronger. He had showered right before coming, so he knew she was imagining it, and he was offended. Though years later, when he washed his clothes every time he wore them and used deodorant sometimes twice a day, he thought differently and was embarrassed. "We've been using the procedure for 10 years, the woman began, in his language. She spoke it fluently, without a trace of accent. "We know there are no long-term effects." "If you consider 10 years long-term." But he just nodded. She explained it again in a monologue worn smooth by repetition, how they would reopen critical period plasticity in his brain, how the changes would last for several months, how, during that time, he would effortlessly rewire his neural networks to cope with a new environment, the way children did. How he would pick up his new language without even having to try. She did mention, in the same weary monotone, that the new neural pathways would inevitably replace pre-existing ones. Neural plasticity was competitive. There was no space in the brain that wasn't in use. When his mind restructured itself to gain a new language, it would lose something else. Not necessarily his old language. They couldn't predict how the brain would remap itself. "It's usually something useless," she said. "Something you can learn again or do without." By then, he had met plenty of people who had undergone the procedure. For some, he knew, it was obvious what they had forgotten. The words of a song they had loved, the road map of their home city, the stories their parents had told them. Others were never sure. He wished there was a way to know what he would forget, so he could weigh the choices rationally. Then he tried to think of something more valuable than the ability to speak. "All right," he said. "I'll do it." "You're making the right decision," the official said, and smiled thinly as she pushed the forms across the desk for him to sign. Later, of course, he was happy with his choice. Everyone was. And though at first he tried to figure out what he had forgotten, eventually he gave up. Not because he didn't care, but because he didn't have time. It wasn't until decades later, when his daughter did a report for school and he told her about his entry into the country, that he thought about it again. By then, the official had been proven correct. There were no permanent side effects. She had been correct, too, about it being the right decision. He remembered that interview now, with a faint echo of shame. He couldn't help wondering what would have become of him had he declined the procedure. But he also couldn't remember why he would have wanted to.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrud, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.